I just fell in love with the game of basketball, being around it all the time. The problem was I wasn't very big. For a basketball player, I was small by stature. I was only 5'11", 155 pounds when I graduated high school. You know, my dad's pet peeve was shooting, constantly working with me on my shot. And that was one thing I could always do was put the ball in the basket. And even in high school, and even though not being very big, you know, I was able to average like 31 points a game in high school when there wasn't even a three-point line. So I always just had that ability, even though I didn't pass the eye test. People saw me walking up, and I'd go speak somewhere, and they thought, hey, this guy must be the guy that's going to introduce the NBA player because he sure doesn't look like one.
And you are in Australia right now.
You're talking NBA basketball. You're talking great teams. You're talking great individual players.
Takes it off, and there's number 23. And, of course, Johnny goes nuts.
So we're all getting goosebumps thinking about it now.
I just tried to go out there and play my game.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Adam. I don't like anybody. I'm not a people person.
Grant, you make the pass, yes. Christian, can you catch the ball, yes.
All the stars were aligned, and all the muscles fired at the right time, and I was able to get off the ground and throw one down.
I was saving that as a surprise for you.
And now, introducing your host for In All Airness, Adam Ryan.
Welcome to episode 87. Thanks for joining me. Today, I'm very pleased to welcome Mark Price to the show. We discuss his outstanding high school, college, and pro career. Plus, Mark talks about his post-playing days and his journey that led him to being recently announced as an assistant coach for the Denver Nuggets. A big thanks to Laura Price, Mark's wife, who was instrumental in helping us connect for this chat. After listening to our conversation, I'm sure that you'll agree Mark is knocking on the door of the Basketball Hall of Fame. Towards the end of the episode, I'll share another great podcast review. You can add yours by visiting inallairness.com/review. Show notes for this episode, including links to numerous topics covered, will be available at inallairness.com/87. Now, onto the show. My guest today excelled in high school and enjoyed an outstanding career at Georgia Tech. He is a four-time NBA All-Star, Cleveland Cavaliers legend, was named All-NBA First Team in 1993, and was a member of Dream Team 2. He's a 12-year NBA veteran. Mark Price, thanks very much for joining me.
My pleasure, Adam. Good to be on with you.
Thank you again, and thanks to Laura, your wife, for helping us connect. I really appreciate that. Now, doing research for our chat today, your father, Denny, was an Oklahoma great, and like you, he starred in high school and would play college ball as well. Now, as the oldest of three brothers, were you, Matt, and Brent destined to play basketball, and what was it like to learn the game from your dad, who had also coached in the NBA and at college level as well?
Well, it was you know, it was so much fun. My dad coached at every level, high school, college, at the University of Oklahoma, and then was assistant for the Phoenix Suns for 2 years when I was about 10 years old. And I just remember being, you know, such a fan at that age, getting a chance to go to NBA games every night, and just thinking how great those players were going way back in the day. Like, you know, you're talking about Connie Hawkins and Dick Van Arsdale and Paul Westphal, guys like that that I admired when I was growing up. And I just fell in love with the game of basketball, being around it all the time. The problem was I wasn't very big. For a basketball player, I was small by stature. I was only 5'11", 155 pounds when I graduated high school. You know, my dad's pet peeve was shooting, constantly working with me on my shot. And that was one thing I could always do was put the ball in the basket. And even in high school, and even though not being very big, you know, I was able to average like 31 points a game in high school when there wasn't even a three-point line. So I always just had that ability, even though I didn't pass the eye test. People saw me walking up, and I'd go speak somewhere, and they thought, hey, this guy must be the guy that's going to introduce the NBA player because he sure doesn't look like one.
Wow. That's really good to hear that background there, and to have your dad associated with all different levels of coaching as well. It must have been some experience for you just having your father involved in that and then also playing with your brothers as well. I believe your brother, Matt, was on your high school team at Enid High School.
He was. My senior year in 1982, we got to the state championship game, and my brother, Matt, was a sophomore, on the team. We had like 10 seniors. He was like one of the only sophomores on the team, and he started for us. And that was just a blast to get to play with my brother and get a chance to go all the way to the state championship game. And that was just an experience that I'll never forget. Matt actually went on to play at Appalachian State in college for a couple years and went back and played for my dad as well. And he had a couple of back surgeries while in college. It kind of ended his basketball career. But he gets kind of lost in the shuffle sometimes because my younger brother, Brent, went on to be a pro as well. And so, but Matt was a very good player in his own right.
We'll get to a bit about Brent later in our chat too, but he had almost a 10-year career in the NBA, of course, and you were teammates at one stage too. So I look forward to asking you about that. You mentioned Enid High School in Oklahoma. As a senior, you led your team to the Class 5A finals, if I'm not mistaken, and had an incredible 42-point performance that actually tied your dad's 27-year-old state tournament record. So I was just stunned when I read that. What a fantastic coincidence and circumstance there. How did it feel to equal the record that your dad had set almost three decades earlier?
It was really cool to tie my dad's record, but I actually missed a free throw at the end of that game. But I didn't even know how many points I had at the time. A lot of people later on accused me of missing on purpose so that we would tie the record, but I didn't even know how many points I had. Had I made that free throw at the end, I would have broken his record. But it was really, really cool that we share that. And I think it might still be a record today for a state tournament game. I'm not sure.
Incredible. You say you missed that free throw. You're well known as one of the greatest free throw shooters of all time. I think when you retired from the NBA, you were the career leader. Just a tick over 90%. You mentioned how your dad was stressing the fundamentals of the game when you were growing up. What led you to develop that incredible touch from the free throw line where some people can get psyched out completely and you've seen plenty of games lost at the free throw line? You seem to thrive when you were shooting free throws under pressure.
I think I just spent so much time shooting free throws and practicing, and it was, once again, it was kind of a pet peeve of my dad. I didn't want to hear my dad gripe about it because I'd come in, I might have 30 points, 15 assists, and the only thing he'd ask me about was the free throw I missed. I didn't want to hear it from my dad, so I figured I better make all my free throws and end that problem.
That's fantastic. I love that. Now, I read with interest that during your high school career, you played in the 16 and under National Junior Olympics with a team that were called the Oklahoma Rams alongside the great Wayman Tisdale, the late great Wayman Tisdale, I should add. How did you fare in those Junior Olympics, and what impact did Wayman have on you and your life?
Wayman and I were good friends. His team and my team were actually in the same conference in high school, so we played each other like twice a year, and those were always big rivalry games between our two schools. I mean, Wayman was he was a number one recruit out of high school his senior year. He was just an unbelievable high school player. He was 6'9", you know, 240, just could score, was unbelievably gifted. A lot of people, you know, thought we should have gone to Oklahoma together, you know, and had quite a formidable team there. But it, you know, it was the right place for me to go to Georgia Tech and Wayman to Oklahoma. But those Oklahoma Rams teams were unbelievable. We had guys like Chu Kennedy on those teams, Anthony Bowie, who played in the NBA as well. And so people thought we weren't very good. I'd never heard of AAU ball up until I get a call from a guy that owned a fried chicken place in Oklahoma City. And he said he was putting together a team of the better players out of Oklahoma going down to Florida to play in a tournament. Some college coaches are going to be there. And so I was like, well, I'm in. Because at that time, I wasn't even being recruited much, you know, after my junior year or anything. And so we go down to Florida. We get to the finals of that tournament. And we end up playing New York City, who had guys like Chris Mullin on their team. It was an unbelievable experience and a real kind of coming out party for a lot of the kids from Oklahoma, because Oklahoma was not really known as a basketball state, but we had some terrific players on that team, and we went out and played great in that tournament, and that really kind of put us on the map.
Your scoring average as a senior, you left Enid High School at 31.2 points per game, and you were named the High School Player of the Year, and I believe that was the same honor that your father had achieved back in the 1950s. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
How did it feel to sort of repeat something that your father did so many years earlier and ahead of players like Wayman Tisdale, who you just mentioned, you were named the Player of the Year. So it's a fantastic achievement in itself.
Yeah, it really was. Like I said, our team wasn't predicted to be that that good my senior year. We were kind of small. We played in the same conference with Wayman Tisdale's team. They were predicted to kind of win the whole thing that year. But we had a fantastic year. I had a fantastic year, and I ended up being named player of the year that year. Like you said, my father had done that in the 50s, and my dad was always my hero growing up. So to be able to do that was really, really exciting for me.
I can only imagine. In terms of college, you said that there was a possibility that you could have teamed up with Wayman and gone to Oklahoma. What was the motivating factor, perhaps, for you to sign with Georgia Tech?
Well, I think one of the big factors, obviously, Georgia Tech was in the ACC at the time. And back then, the ACC, there was like no question that it was the best college basketball conference in the United States. I mean, just the traditions of North Carolina, Duke, Virginia, all those schools, just the thrill of getting a chance to compete against those teams. But at the same time, Bobby Crimmins had just gotten a job at Georgia Tech, and it was kind of a rebuild program. And to get in on the beginning of that, I knew that I would get a lot of playing time as a freshman because of that situation. And that was something I felt like I really needed for my career. And so it ended up being a great thing. We went from last. We started four freshmen. John Sally came with me at Georgia Tech, and we started that program. And 3 years later, we were able to win an ACC championship. So it was a fantastic experience and run. And I love those teams at Georgia Tech, and obviously playing for Bobby Crimmins.
Hmm. When Bobby Crimmins took over the team, I think the team had only won four games that season. So you joined as they were just starting to build into what obviously would become. The team went 13-15, and you led the ACC in scoring at 20.3 points per game, which is a great effort given the depth of talent that was in that conference. You're also named the ACC Rookie of the Year. What did you make of the jump from high school to that first season playing in college, Mark?
It was an eye-opening experience. Obviously, you go to that level, and the level of talent that you're playing against every night is you're playing against some of the best players in college on a nightly basis. I think, you know, just about every point guard I played against in the ACC ended up making it to the NBA. And you had guys like Kenny Smith in North Carolina, Johnny Dawkins at Duke, Muggsy Bogues was at Wake Forest, you had Spud Webb and Nate McMillan at NC State. It was just like every night you were playing against a really great player. So to be able to lead the league in scoring my first year there was kind of rare. And it was funny. A lot of people don't know that was the first year college experimented. The ACC was the first conference to experiment with the three-point shot. And so we played with a three-point shot during conference play only. That helped me obviously win the scoring title because of that. And then the NCAA didn't put it in until 3 years later after I graduated. And then they put the three-point line in. I always kind of said that was the Mark Price rule. They waited till I left college before they put it back in.
I love it. That's fantastic. I didn't actually know about that little quirk there. So, yeah, that's quite interesting. Just before we get to your sophomore season, I'd love to briefly touch on the 1983 Pan American Games. They were in mid to late August of 83, which is basically 35 years ago, certainly dating both of us there. Your team USA was stacked with some great players, including Michael Jordan, the aforementioned Wayman Tisdale. You had Sam Perkins, Chris Mullen, Michael Cage, Ed Pinckney, just to name some of the great talent, along with yourself, of course. Now, you went 8-0. You averaged a bit over 8 points a game and scored 12 points in the second to last game I've found, which actually was the gold medal clinching game against Brazil. So reading up about these games, I also learnt, and it's a bit of a preamble, but I'll get to the point, that Chris Mullen actually broke his foot in one of the exhibition games before the competition began, and then Michael Cage was actually returning home after a couple of games due to a family illness. So was this the first time that you'd been overseas, and what do you remember most about that experience at such a young age?
It was the first time that I had been overseas. It was in Venezuela, Caracas, Venezuela, is where the tournament was held. It was an unbelievable experience to go get a chance to play against other countries. It was one of those situations where we were all still college players. The international play hadn't, you know, evolved to where NBA players were playing back then. So we were actually playing against a lot of professional players from other countries. And so it was a real, real good challenge and a real great opportunity to get a chance to be a part of that team.
Have you managed to see any of the games since? A couple of minutes of highlights here and there on YouTube, and they're fascinating to watch.
No, I actually haven't seen much footage of that. So now that you mentioned some of it's there, I may try to look that up and check it out.
For what it's worth, I'll definitely send you some links to stuff that I've viewed as well. It's rare footage for sure, but it's fascinating to watch. Just returning back to your sophomore season, you were named the team captain and you shared that honour with John Sally, who'd be a future four-time NBA champion. Now, you were team captains throughout the rest of your college careers. And again, the team improved. This time you went 18 and 11. What was it like to play alongside a young John Sally?
The thing that was neat about John and myself is that we were both underrated guys coming into college. I was small. I was 5'11", 155 pounds. John Sally was like 6'9", 185. So he was real thin too. John grew 3 inches in college, ended up being 7 feet. I continued to expand my game and get stronger as a player. And so that development coming in together, you know, we were great teammates together. I loved playing with John. He was just, he was a great teammate on the floor. Defensively, he was a shot blocker. Our games complemented us really well. And it just allowed to keep adding pieces. You know, we continued to add guys like Dwayne Farrell and Tom Hammonds and Craig Neal, Yvonne Jessica, different guys, Bruce Dalrymple. Each year we added, seems like, another piece to the puzzle that allowed us to just get better and better as a team.
Not long after that 1984 college season ended, Team USA invited you to the Olympic basketball trials that were at Indiana University Fieldhouse. Now, approximately 70 players took part in 2 or 3 day practices and scrimmages, and then the group was eventually whittled down to the final squad of 12, plus a few alternates. Now, of course, as most people listening to this would know, USA was undefeated, won the gold medal at the Forum in LA in the 1984 Olympics. But as a member of the 1983 Pan Am Games gold medal team, how would you describe the experience that you had at the trials, and what did you make of that whole scenario?
You know, Bobby Knight obviously was the coach for that 84 team, and I think he had an idea going in. Which guys that he wanted on that team. One of the guys was Steve Alford, who was going to go play at Indiana. So there was a lot of talk about Bobby taking Steve over guys like me or John Stockton, who was there at the trials as well. It was a great experience to go and compete against guys at the very top of the college game at that time in our careers. And, you know, disappointing. We felt like winning the gold medal at the Pan Am Games that we would have a real good shot of making the Olympic team. But, you know, they didn't take very many guys off of our Pan Am team other than Michael Jordan. They took a pretty much brand new squad.
Chatting about your junior season with the Yellow Jackets, it was a great season. You went 27-8 and you were ACC champions and then made it deep into the NCAA tournament. Individually, you were the ACC Player of the Year and had a first-team All-American nod as well. Before we chat about the tournament, what do you think made this season so special from a team or even an individual standpoint?
From a talent standpoint, people might say my senior year we had more individual talent on our team, but my junior year, the pieces just all seemed to fit together. We had a really close-knit team. We had a lot of confidence coming off of our second year at Tech there and the momentum that we had built, and we just were able to make a great run. And then winning the ACC championship, we had to beat North Carolina for the third time that season, which is, I don't know very many teams that have ever done that. So that was quite an accomplishment, something that we were very proud of and really catapulted us to making a really good run in the NCAA tournament as well.
Well, we talked about free throws earlier. On March the 10th of 1985, you made 4 straight free throws in the game's last 22 seconds to help Tech defeat North Carolina and win the ACC championship. It was 57-54, and you were actually named tournament MVP. The Tar Heels were led by someone we'll be chatting about a bit later, Brad Daugherty. Where do you rank the achievement of that ACC championship in terms of either your college career or your overall life in basketball?
Well, it was definitely one of the highlights, the top probably 1 or 2 accomplishments of my whole basketball career, because, you know, Georgia Tech was a place when I went there, a lot of people said we could never win in the ACC because of the stiff competition. By doing that, by winning that championship, it allowed us to cement ourselves. It was actually the first ACC championship by Georgia Tech in basketball in the ACC. And so, you know, that was just an unbelievable accomplishment that we were able to pull off and do, and something that I'll always be really proud of.
If my calculations are correct, the 85 NCAA tournament was Georgia Tech's first appearance in 25 years. Now, in round one, you had 14 points and clinched a 65-58 win over Mercer with 27 seconds left. What do you recall of the emotions of being part of the NCAA tournament for the first time? And I think it was played at the Omni, too, in Atlanta.
It was. We were excited, one, to be playing in our home city. But at the same time, I think we were really nervous. You know, that first game, the NCAA tournament, it doesn't matter what school you play. It's like, you know, one loss and you're out. So that was our first experience in that environment. And I think that we got off to a little bit of a slow start in that game. Mercer played really well, gave us a tough game, but we finally were able to pull it out. And we really started playing really good basketball after that game.
You had some massive crowds at the Omni from what I've read, and a lot of them actually dwarfed some of the crowds that the Atlanta Hawks were getting at the time in the NBA. So the atmosphere, I guess, at some of these games at the Omni would have been just off the charts.
They really were. Like I said, I think the excitement in Atlanta, the whole city, because of what we were building at Georgia Tech, everybody just kind of adopted us as their team, you know, there in Atlanta. And a lot of our bigger games like North Carolina, Duke, we would play in the Omni. We played our rivals Georgia in there, and just it seemed like we always drew really, really big crowds. People got excited about our program, and to be able to host a couple NCAA games there was fantastic.
Yeah, well, the round two game was also at the Omni, and you had 18 points as Tech defeated Syracuse 70-53. So you advanced to the Sweet 16, and there you met Illinois, and you had a stellar game, 20 points on 9 of 12 from the field, and won that one 61-53. So Georgia Tech made the Elite Eight for the first time in school history. The only thing standing between you and the Final Four at that stage were the Georgetown Hoyas that were led by, of course, legendary Patrick Ewing. The Hoyas held on to win that game 60-54. What do you make of that run deep into the tournament and going up against such a force as Patrick Ewing-led Hoyer team?
Well, we really felt going into the tournament that the two best teams in the whole tournament were Georgetown and us. And unfortunately, we got put in the same bracket for some reason and had to play each other in the Elite Eight to get to the Final Four. So we were disappointed with that. But the other disappointing was I actually did not have one of my better games against Georgetown. I didn't shoot as well as I normally do, and I was obviously disappointed by that. But Georgetown obviously was a great team, a team that competed for the national championship just about every year while Patrick Ewing was there. To be in that game, to be right there, we really felt like, you know, we were just as good as Georgetown, but unfortunately didn't have our best game.
Moving on to your senior season, the team went 27-7. You made it to the Sweet 16. Now, I read that on the 2nd of March in 1986, it was a pregame ceremony. Your number 25 jersey was retired, as was John Sally's number 22. As of this recording, Tech has only retired six numbers in its history. So this was the last game of the regular season, and it was your final appearance at home. You defeated Horace Grant and Clemson. 74-63. The next day in the Atlanta Constitution, you were quoted as saying, "This is a day that I'm going to remember for a long time." What's your memories now of, I think it was called Senior Appreciation Day, some 32 years later?
It was a fantastic day. It had a lot of my family, most of my family from Oklahoma had come out to Atlanta. So many friends, so many friendships that we built while we were there for the 4 years at Georgia Tech. To have your school, you know, retire your jersey and show you that appreciation for all the work that you put in is really special. It still hits you, you know, every time I go back to that arena and look up in the rafters and see my jersey hanging there, it brings a tear to your eye. You know, it's just a special place for me, and we had a lot of great memories there.
Remarkable achievement, and yeah, fantastic stuff. Now, in round one of the 86 NCAA tournament, your Tech squad defeated Rick Smits and Marist 68-53. Now, you had 20 points and Rick scored 22 points in the loss. You then went to take on the 85 NCAA champs Villanova in round two. you held on for a 66-61 victory, and again, you scored 20 points. So this leads us to the Sweet 16, which was at the Omni in Atlanta. It was your final college game, and you took on LSU, who came away with a win, unfortunately. It was 70-64, and for a third time, you dropped 20 points. What do you make of that 1986 version of the Yellow Jackets? You did say it included up-and-coming future NBA players, too, of Dwayne Farrell and Tom Hammonds.
Yeah, we had a fantastic team my senior year as well. We were probably our most talented team we had, but it was probably a little bit more disappointing. We felt like we should have gotten to the Final Four that year. We got to the Sweet 16, and the games were in Atlanta and the Omni. They were kind of on our home court, so to speak, and we just, you know, ran into a hot LSU team that got hot at the right time and ended up getting to the Final Four. So that was disappointing. I would have liked to have ended my college career on a different note, but even still, it was a fantastic run. What we were able to start and build at Georgia Tech is something I'll always be very proud of.
You left college with career averages of 17.4 points and 4 assists per game, and this is all courtesy of the Georgia Tech record books online. You're a starter in all 126 games played, and you rank third all-time, as we record this, in points scored. You're the career leader in steals, and according to the record books, you're the only player to ever lead the team in scoring 4 straight years. So when you look back on that, as well as the team's overall success, particularly in the latter 2 seasons, there's some incredible records that still stand to this day.
Yeah, it was a special team, no doubt about it. And those 4 of the best years of my life. I loved playing at Georgia Tech. It was an unbelievable experience getting to compete against great teams in the ACC night in, night out. Something I always cherish.
The 1986 NBA draft, you were selected with the first pick of the second round. It was 25th overall by the Dallas Mavericks. And then the Mavs traded you to the Cleveland Cavaliers for a 1989 second round pick, and I think future considerations. Whereabouts were you on draft day, and what do you recall about being selected to the NBA?
Well, I went back to Oklahoma. I had no idea, you know, where I would get drafted, or if I would get drafted. You just never knew. It wasn't as detailed as it is now. I think most players today have a pretty good idea of where they might get drafted. It wasn't the case with me. I think I was a little bit of one of those guys that people weren't quite sure if I would be good enough to play at the NBA level. Once again, going back to, I didn't pass the eye test, so to speak, of an NBA player from my size and stature. And I think people tended to look at things maybe that things I might not be able to do rather than focus on the things that I was really good at. But Cleveland liked me a lot. You know, they made a deal with Dallas. I was still there, which I was, you know, in my own personal opinion, felt like I was passed over too many times in the first round. I thought I might have a chance to go to the Hawks. They had the 20th pick that year, having played there in Atlanta so much, but they decided to go a different direction as well. So I landed in Cleveland, and it ended up being, wouldn't have wanted it any different. The opportunity that I got to play in Cleveland and develop my career, and the guys like Brad Daugherty and Larry Nance, Ron Harper, all those guys I got to play with. It was just an unbelievable group of guys. And once again, I got to come in on the ground floor of a rebuilding situation. The team in Cleveland hadn't been very good. Matter of fact, I think their nickname was the Cadavers there for a while with a lot of people. And we were able to turn that around and become a perennial playoff team going into my second year there.
How did you actually react to that tag of Cadavers? Not sure if it was a Peter Vesey nickname or who actually dubbed you that, but when you got to the team and you heard that as the name for the squad, how did you guys react as a team when that was mentioned?
You know, like I said, we all came in together. I think that is probably doesn't get as much credit of one of the best drafts by any team in NBA history. I mean, Brad Daugherty, Ron Harper, me, Johnny Newman. You had Hot Rod Williams, who was already there but couldn't play the year before. I mean, it was an unbelievable draft, you know, by the Cleveland Cavaliers to turn that franchise around, because that was the core group of guys that we got to stay together for quite a while and really turn that thing around. It was a fantastic group of guys, and we just looked at it like an opportunity. We knew we were going to be good. We just had to get out there and grow and play together and mature as a team. It was a lot of fun playing with those guys.
You had a lot of rookies on the squad in that first season that were big contributors for sure, and Brad Daugherty was the number one pick. How much had you had to do with Brad when you were ACC competitors? Because he was playing at North Carolina. So did you have much chance at all to develop any sort of relationship with him prior to when the regular season kicked off?
No, I really didn't. We just knew each other. We played against each other for 4 years, and so we were very familiar with each other's games, but I didn't know Brad personally at all. But I think just playing in the ACC, there's a certain style that a lot of guys' teams played coming out of that league, and we ended up having a lot of guys on our team. Larry Nance played at Clemson, you know, Brad at Carolina, me from Georgia Tech. Brad and I just seemed to click together really well from the beginning when we got there, particularly when it came to pick and roll play.
If I have this right, prior to you signing with the Cavaliers, which happened a bit later on in the year, sometime in October, I read a Joe Menza, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing his name right, it was an article in the News Journal, and it said that you were training with Athletes in Action, which is a Christian group of former college players, I believe, who played against some of the pros during that time. And it was hard to find a bit more information, but you played against teams like the Warriors, Suns, and Clippers. I'm not sure when the last time would have been that you reminisced about that period of time before playing with the Cavs, but do you remember much about that time with Athletes in Action as far as getting yourself set to sign with the Cavs?
Yeah, I do. I remember very well because, matter of fact, the guy that was coaching that team is Lorenzo Romar, who you know, is now the head coach. He's been a head coach at Washington and is now at Pepperdine. But I was trying to negotiate my contract. I wasn't so sure it was going to work out with the Cavs, and so I went out, I called Lorenzo and asked him if I could work out with their team. And so in doing that, I got experience, like you said, getting to play scrimmage games against teams like the Warriors and the Suns. And it was a great experience from that standpoint and just kind of let me know that I definitely was the guy that could play in the NBA. And then about 2 weeks later, we got things worked out with the Cavaliers and I went to Cleveland.
Gotcha. So upon signing with Cleveland, the new coach, Lenny Wilkins, of course, legendary Lenny Wilkins, he talked about your game and said, quote, "He reads the court real well, and when he sees a guy open, the ball is there," end quote. Your preseason debut, if I have this right, was on October the 14th of 86 at Raleigh, North Carolina. Atlanta defeated you guys 126-98 in just a throwaway preseason game, I suppose. But do you remember much of that first time on the court as an NBA player?
Not a lot. I don't remember a lot of that. It's been so long ago. But I do remember I was pretty nervous. First experience against NBA players. You know, here I was, a little kid from Oklahoma playing in the big time. And it was quite an experience. But I tried to take every day as an opportunity to get better and grow and learn from every experience. And I think my toughness and growing up all the way back, growing up in a basketball family with my dad, and I was around it like that. Those kind of situations didn't intimidate me, even though I might have been a little nervous. But I was a competitor, and I wanted to go out and show people that I was good enough to play in the NBA.
Well, the ACC definitely would have held you in good stead as well, coming off that to then enter the pros. Just for what it's worth, according to the newspaper articles, you had 4 points and 4 assists in 15 minutes in that first preseason game. An interesting tidbit about that first season in the NBA, the Cavaliers' top 3 scorers that season were all rookies, Ron Harper, Brad Daugherty, and Hot Rod Williams. I'm not sure how many times in NBA history, as you alluded to earlier, that multiple rookies would have been leading the team in scoring, but that was quite interesting, I would have thought. Your regular season NBA debut was in early November of 86. You scored 8 points. And then in that season, you played 67 games as a rookie coming off the bench. You averaged just under 7 points and 3 assists a game. And Cleveland went 31-51. You had a season high 27 points on 11 of 16 from the field in December against the Philadelphia 76ers. Do you happen to recall that standout game, or just what did you think about that first season playing in the pros?
It was a real learning experience. I was backing up John Bagley, who was a starting point guard that year, and so I just looked at every opportunity I got. I really felt like I was really starting to come on, strong my first year. When in the middle of it, I had an emergency appendix situation that I had to get my appendix taken out. And so I missed like a month of the season. And so coming back, I was a little up and down the rest of the year because I wasn't in great condition and things like that due to my surgery. That's actually when they brought Craig Elo onto the team, which at first I hated Craig because I was homesick and he was playing well and the fans were chanting Elo at the games. And so we ended up being best friends, playing together for a lot of years. But that's a great story, and that's kind of how that all came about.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you about that. So you've read my mind beautifully there. So aside from obviously a terrible emergency surgery that needed to be performed, that opened the door for Elo to join the squad. I think you were placed on the injured list maybe on January the 12th, from what I've got here on my notes. The next day, they signed Craig as a free agent and a 10-day contract, and then he'd go on to sign for the rest of that season. We'll get to your jersey retirement with the Cavs later on, but Craig was there on that night as well, which was fantastic to see. And he's a former guest on the podcast here, so I've got a soft spot for Craig as well because he is a great guy when I had a chat to him too. Moving into the 87-88 campaign, you went 42-40, so you improved again, which was great. It was the team's first winning season, I've since learned, thanks to basketballreference.com, since 1978. It was also the first of five postseason meetings you'd have with the Chicago Bulls, and Jordan played in four of those contests. You took the number 3-seeded Chicago to a fifth and deciding game in the 88 playoffs before they ultimately hung on to win 107-101 in game five. Just a quick background here. You had a great series yourself. You averaged 21 points, 7.6 assists, and 3.6 rebounds a game. It was your first experience of NBA playoffs. What did you make about that 1988 series against the Bulls? And how was the step up to playing in NBA playoffs compared to what you experienced prior?
Well, I think it was kind of the next step for our team to make the playoffs was important. And then you learn how much the intensity gets ratcheted up once it becomes a playoff game. And those, particularly back when the series were five games, every game is so crucial. You lose a game on the road early and you're in real trouble because you got to go play two games at the other place. And so you learn real fast how important those playoff games are, and it's certainly the intensity and the focus by the teams steps up to another level.
Just for context, Jordan averaged 45.2 points a game in that series and had back-to-back 50-point efforts in Chicago to open the series. Now, you actually participated in the 1988 NBA All-Star Weekend in Chicago. It'd be remiss of me not to ask about the three-point shootout that year. What was that experience like to just be part of that? And looking back now, it is one of the great All-Star weekends in NBA history. Do you remember much about either the event itself or just being associated with the All-Stars, who you'd actually be a part of the All-Star team for the East the following year?
It was such a fun experience for me and Laura to get to go and be a part of that. And not only to be in the NBA, but here I am now playing in the All-Star game. Was just, I would have never thought something like that would happen. And so I was just so excited to be there and get a chance to play with the great players in the league. I was fortunate early in my career to play against so many of the great players like Larry Bird and Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Magic Johnson, all those kind of guys. So to go be a part of an All-Star game, and play on the same floor with so many legends, I was in awe a little bit. Sometimes I felt like getting autographs more than going out and playing the game.
I can understand. I mean, just watching him back on DVD or on YouTube these days, it was at the Astrodome, the 89 All-Star game in Houston. And just to see the collection of talent on the floor and to know that you were a part of that, you were voted onto that team. I can only imagine how it must have felt. Just it would have been spine tingling.
Oh, it was, like you said, to be voted on the team by the opposing coaches and players and things like that probably meant more than like getting voted on, you know, by fans, because it just lets you know how much your peers in the game respect what you do. And so, you know, that was quite an honor and something that I really, really appreciated.
Fantastic memories. In 1989, your Cavaliers had a great regular season. You went 57-25 and had the best record to that point in franchise history. And that gave you the number 3-seed in the Eastern Conference. The Cavaliers had Chicago's number, beating the Bulls in all six meetings during the regular season by an average of more than 10 points a game. It was your best season to date. with averaging almost 19 points a game, over 8 assists and 4 rebounds. So just fantastic numbers. No doubt you played in the All-Star game, of course, in 89. What do you think was the reason behind the team's continued improvement? Obviously, you guys were gelling together, but it was a big step up and you had the best record in the franchise's history. So what sort of springs to mind when you think about the 89 squad, Mark?
I think just the momentum that we came off of being in the playoffs for the first time in 88 was just a real confidence booster for our young team. And then to have another offseason, another year of maturity, all of us growing up, getting a little bit older, understanding what it took to be one of the top teams. Our goal was to be one of the top teams in the Eastern Conference that season in 89. And we just, from the preseason on, we just kind of, you know, had that mental mindset to be that. And we were pretty focused all the way through. The disappointing part for us that year, I really felt good enough to compete for the Eastern Conference title. We had some injuries late in the season. Matter of fact, I pulled my groin muscle, which I couldn't even play in the first game of the playoffs in that year in 89, which was a big factor in us losing game one to the Bulls, because as you mentioned, we did dominate the Bulls in the regular season that year and no doubt felt like we were the better team going into that playoff series. But unfortunately, we were pretty banged up. You know, to get it to a game five and have a chance to win it despite all that was pretty amazing. But the thing people always remember is Jordan hitting a shot to win that series.
I won't belabor the point too much by asking you about it again, because I'm sure you've been asked countless times. Just a quick preamble about that 89 series. Here in Australia, one of the very first games I ever recorded on VHS tape was game 5 of that first round series. My brother Luke and I watched it countless times over the years. You set out game 1, as you said, of the series with a pulled groin muscle. Craig Ehlo also, I think, set out the third game. He'd sprained an ankle or something in practice. After that game 1 loss at home in Cleveland, Terry Pluto in the Akron Beacon Journal quoted you saying, "Right now, I'd like to try and play Sunday, even if I have to crawl out there. It'd kill me to watch this game. I can't remember being this frustrated in a long time," end quote. So as we record this, in less than a year from now, it'll be 30 years since that famous series happened. Before we get to game 5 itself, what did you make of the first 4 games and just the seesaw nature of the series to that point?
Well, like I said, and that was really true, it was very, very frustrating to watch not be able to be out on the court in game 1 and to watch the team lose to Chicago at home and really put us behind the eight ball, so to speak, in that series. And Chicago got their confidence after that game. We actually came back and won game 2 and then go to Chicago and they win game 3. We had to win game 4 at Chicago to get it back to Cleveland, and we won a real close, hard-fought, gutty game in Chicago to get it back to Cleveland. So it was an unbelievable series. Put it up, and obviously game 5 was one for the record books. It was an unbelievable finish, and what people don't remember is that with 6 seconds to go, we were down 1 and had the ball. Ehlo throws it in. Michael turns his head. Craig cuts to the basket and scores a layup and scores with 3 seconds. And we go up and the crowd's just going nuts. But then obviously 3 seconds was too long because Michael came down to the other end. So, I mean, the emotions of going elation to such disappointment in that arena that day was just, it's hard to explain how devastating that loss was for our team.
Can you try and relay how the feeling was inside Richfield Coliseum the moment after Craig's go-ahead layup?
Oh, it was unreal atmosphere. I've been in a lot of great buildings, but I don't think I've ever been in a building that was as loud as when Craig hit that shot and we took the lead in the place. I just thought the roof was going to come off of the building. It was so loud. And then, you know, Michael hits that shot at the end, and it was just devastating to everybody in the building. We could at least leave the building knowing that, I mean, we had given everything we possibly had, even though we came up short. You know, we lost to a great player who made a great shot, and that's really all it came down to.
Do you rewatch the game at all? When would be the last time you would have even seen highlights from that series?
Well, I'll catch bits and pieces of it because it seems like that game's on Hardwood Classics about every other week. I get texts from somebody say, hey, you're on Hardwood Classics. And I'm like, which game is it that they're showing? If it's a game we win, watch it, but I'm not watching that.
That's a fantastic answer. I appreciate you sharing that. Now, your 1990 Cavaliers were injury-plagued early in the season and also lost Ron Harper, who was traded to the Clippers in mid-November of 89. And from an individual standpoint, that was your highest-scoring season. You had almost 20 points a game. And aside from the injury-shortened season, you had a career best of 9.1 assists per game. In early March, though, Cleveland was 25-34 before you caught fire and finished 17-6 to make it into the playoffs, where you met Charles Barkley and the 76ers. For a third straight year, you went to a series deciding Game 5. In terms of that 1990 campaign, what do you remember about the sort of slowish start, losing Ron Harper, and then the build towards making that playoff run?
Yeah, it was an interesting year. Obviously, losing Ron Harper was a big loss for us. I love playing with Ron. I thought we had one of the more fearsome backcourts in the NBA with Ron, myself, and Craig Elo coming off the bench. We're pretty formidable backcourt. So, losing Ron was a big blow. Craig obviously slid over to the starting spot at that point in the season. And then we had to dig ourselves out of a slow start, like you mentioned. But we did right the ship. We finished strong at the end of the year, but ended up having to play a pretty good Philadelphia 76ers team with Charles Barkley first round.
In terms of the 1991 season, you played 16 games to start the year before injuring your knee on what I've read was a press table in a win at Atlanta. That injury kept you out of the rest of the season, and your team missed the playoffs for the first time since, I think it was 1987. What do you recall of that injury, which I guess the injury itself wasn't too dissimilar to what would happen in the future for Ron Harper when he was on the Clippers? And sort of how did it feel to sit out the remainder of that season as the team struggled and then actually would ultimately miss the playoffs?
Well, it was disappointing for me, obviously, to have my season shortened that way. I tore my ACL on a freak play. I was going to save a ball out of bounds. I landed and tore my ACL. Like you said, it was early December. It was disappointing because I felt like we had a really good team that year heading into the season. But, I basically missed the whole rest of the season that year. And, an ACL tear now, people think ACL, you can be back in 5-6 months. But back in 1991, it was a much slower process. As a matter of fact, a lot of people thought it was career ending injury back at that time. A lot of guys, as a matter of fact, I think I might have been the quickest guy back from that in 11 months. But it was a slow, very slow process. My leg was in a cast for about 6 weeks and it kind of looked like a wet noodle when it got out. I had a lot of work to get the strength back in my leg and the ability to get back and playing, but I was able to recover and come back strong the next year.
Yeah, you recovered magnificently because the 1992 season was the first of three straight All-Star appearances. So that'll be four in total.
This hot shooting point guard has the highest career free throw percentage in NBA history. He was a member of the All-NBA first team last season, and he's back at the helm of the Cleveland Cavaliers. Appearing in his fourth All-Star game, Mark Price.
Before we get to the 92 playoffs, do you actually remember that first game back home in Cleveland after returning from the ACL surgery? And how did that feel as you ran onto the court after possibly what could have been a career-ending injury, as we were talking about just a moment ago?
Looking back on that day, I was a little nervous, obviously. Hadn't played ball in a real game for about 11 months. And so to come back, get thrown into the thick of it at the NBA level. But once I got out there and played that game, it was a real confidence booster mentally, that, hey, I'm going to be okay. I really probably wasn't 100% even till the following season. It's that slow of a process, but I was able to play well enough, like you said, to make the All-Star team that year, and we went on to have a good season that year.
Top of the three-pointer, bounce on the right side, goes into the lane, flips it up and in. Price with his first basket in almost a year.
Just a quick setup here for the 92 playoffs. You helped lead the Cavs after sitting out, I think, the first five games of the season, you came in and then they finished 57-25. You were second in scoring, only behind Brad Doherty, and you dished out 7.5 assists per game. Now, because of the way it worked out, Boston, who had the lesser record, because they won the Atlantic Division, they had the number two seed, which gave you guys the number three seed because you're in the same division as the Bulls, who went 67-15. So with that said, in the first round of those playoffs, you met Drazen Petrovic and the New Jersey Nets. You won the series 3-1. I'd just like to quickly ask you about game one of that series. Petrovic dropped 40 points, as did your teammate Brad Doherty, and you had a great game, 35 points and 10 assists. So some incredible numbers. What was it like to play against such a tough competitor as the late, great Drazen Petrovic?
It was a great series, like you said, a lot of firepower. You know, New Jersey was a very good team, had Derek Coleman on that team as well, Drazen Petrovic, Mookie Blaylock. They were a very formidable team as well, very talented. And so it was a very competitive series, a lot of offense on display. Drazen was obviously a great offensive player, and as you mentioned, had 40 points in the first game. He could really shoot the ball and had a really great first game, but we were still able to win that series and move forward in the playoffs.
After winning that series, you then meet Larry Bird and the Boston Celtics. Of course, Bird was on the downhill part of his career in terms of just being ravaged with injuries, particularly his back. But the series went to a seventh and deciding game. He only played 4 games in that series due to his back. Now, the Celtics were led at that stage by the great, and again, unfortunately, died way too soon, Reggie Lewis, who averaged 28 points a game across the series and had 42 at one stage in that series too. What do you remember about matching up with Boston? And more importantly, I guess, how did it feel to advance to the conference finals for the first time in your career?
It was a great series as well. As you mentioned, it was Larry Bird's last season. I tell people all the time I ended Larry's career by us winning that series. I played in his last game he ever played, so that's kind of cool. But Larry was pretty banged up. Obviously, he was not 100%. He was at the end of his career, but even still, just his presence out on the court was amazing. And he had some young, good players around him, like you mentioned, Reggie Lewis, who unfortunately died early in his life. It was a great series.
Yeah, some really fond memories there. And I love that little story about ending Bird's career. That's fantastic. Now, in the 92 Eastern Conference Finals, I'll be dating myself a bit here, but I had videotapes of, I think, 4 out of the 6 games were sent to me over here in Australia weeks after they actually had happened. But Bulls won game one convincingly, but in game two at Chicago, you had 21 of your 23 points in the first half. And hammered the Bulls. It was 107-81, and took the home court back. After game one, and this was mentioned throughout the series on a couple of telecasts, the Chicago media labeled your team as marshmallows in a pre-game segment that was on NBC. I can clearly remember Marv, Mike, and Ahmad. They referenced marshmallows. I think they were out in the car park at Richfield Coliseum.
Now, for more on the marshmallow saga, let's go outside the Coliseum to the parking lot. Here's Ahmad Rashad.
All right, thanks, Marv. I was talking to Michael Jordan just before the game today, and he said for the first time in his career, he was involved in a controversy which he had nothing to do with. The Chicago Press had said that the Cleveland Cavaliers were soft as marshmallows and soft as cream puffs. The result? This is the reaction of the Cleveland fans. Marshmallows and cream puffs. Marv?
Czar, do you like marshmallows?
No.
Bob?
Thank you for that fine report, gentlemen. A look at the Cavs' Mark Price warming up with game time less than 15 minutes away at the Richfield Coliseum. Price scorched the Bulls in game two at Chicago, scoring 21 of his 23 points in the decisive first half, including 4 3-pointers.
Strange how these things pop in my mind. But do you recall the talk about marshmallows and cream puffs? Did you guys or did Coach Wilkins use that in any way to motivate the team as the series went on?
Well, obviously, we heard about, the news reports and hearing people say things. I think what happened was the Bulls had just come off of a pretty physical, grueling series with the New York Knicks, and the Knicks kind of banged them up pretty good. And so after game one, because that's not really the style that we played, I think one of their players, possibly Horace Grant, might have said, well, that was a much easier game than what we just played with the Knicks. And so the media kind of ran with that and somehow turned it into kind of we were a soft team or marshmallows, and in which, you know, anybody that knows basketball knows is ridiculous. We let that fire burn in us for a couple of days, and then we came, as you mentioned, we came out in game two and torched the Bulls, and that pretty much ended most of that marshmallow talk after that.
It definitely did. The Bulls had regained the home court edge in game three. You won game four in Cleveland, and then the Bulls won game five in a blowout win back in Chicago. That led to game six at Cleveland, which was a really hard fought. Ultimately decided by only 5 points, the Bulls held on for 99-94 victory and took the Eastern Conference Championship. It's over 25 years now since that series was played. What are your thoughts now looking back on that deep run into the playoffs and how close you came to making those finals back in 1992?
You know, anytime you get that close to get the chance to play in the finals, you know, you always think, you know, is there anything we could have done differently? Or, you know, as you saw many of the games, it was a really high level series. We played really, really well. We just happened to be playing against, you know, the greatest player, you know, of our era, and, you know, just couldn't quite get over the hump. But, you know, I was really proud of our team and the effort that we put forth. Unfortunately, we came up a little bit short.
I was looking through the great basketballreference.com, which is just a fantastic site for all kinds of info. And I noted that on the 12th of December in 1992, you had a career high 39 points and 5 assists and 3 steals for good measure in a win against Seattle. I think it was 97-93. Does a game like that stand out in your mind? Do you actually remember lighting it up for that amount of points? Or more importantly, is it a team win or where you get a higher number of assists mean more?
Yeah. You know, I was just about trying to win games. It was about our team. There were certain nights that I needed to score. That happened to be one of them. It just happened to be a night where I had a good matchup and I was playing really well and my teammates just kept feeding me the ball. Other nights, if it's Brad Daugherty or Larry Nance or whoever it might be on our team that has a hot hand, then I'm just as happy to throw them the ball and get assists and things like that. So I never really put a whole lot into how much I scored, or as long as we won the game and I was able to help our team win, then I felt good about that effort.
I had a feeling that might have been your similar sort of response. That's the sort of player you are. Now, your Cavs in 93, they went 54-28, and you had another first-round matchup against the Nets in the playoffs. It went to a deciding fifth game, and then you met the Bulls for the fourth time, I think it was, in six postseasons. The series ended with a Bulls victory. It was 4-0 on that last second basket by Jordan in game four. In terms of that game itself that finished the season or your 93 team, how would you sort of rate that amongst how your seasons went?
Once again, I think one of the biggest issues we tended to have was we never were quite healthy as we needed to be going into those playoffs. And, you know, the Bulls, they were rolling at that time and we didn't play well in that series, and they took that. But that was kind of the end of the run for that particular team, because after that season, Lenny Wilkins moved on to coach the Atlanta Hawks and changed teams. And the Cavs brought Mike Fratello in. Brad Daugherty, he was having a lot of back issues that ended his career. And so Larry Nance and guys started to retire. So it was kind of a place in time where the Cavs organization began to start in a different direction after that.
Speaking of the introduction of Mike Fratello after Lenny Wilkins' exit to Atlanta, what did you make of the contrasting styles in their coaching or personalities, and what did you think as the following sort of season went with under the first time that Mike Fratello was at the helm?
Well, Mike was a good basketball coach as well. They certainly had different styles. Mike was a little more fiery personality. You didn't need to wonder what Mike was thinking. He would usually tell you. Lenny was a lot more laid back. We were probably used to that. We played for Lenny for like 7 years. It was a bit of an adjustment when Mike came in. But like I said, at the same time, our roster was changing. About the only two guys kind of left off of those really good runs that we had were Hot Rod Williams and myself. More guys like Terrell Brandon and Bobby Fills and guys like that started coming into to their own as players, and the roster began to change.
I'd love to ask you about the 1994 Dream Team 2. The World Championships were held in Toronto. You demolished everybody in your wake, and you went 8-0 and took the gold. You also played against my national team, the Australian Boomers. The scores were tied early in that first half. I think it was 31 each. But then you guys managed to hold on for a 56-point win. So congratulations for that sort of victory there. 130-74, I found out, was the stats today when I checked them. But when all was said and done, you guys took the gold and you had 17 points in that game against Australia. Overall, in terms of being a member of that squad, I think it was the first time NBA players were featured in the World Championships to that point. What do you remember most, either about the team itself or just the experience being in Toronto, winning a gold medal at the championships? What comes to mind?
A lot of things come to mind. Obviously, it's a great experience to get an opportunity to represent your country in the game of basketball. And although, you know, it wasn't the Olympics, it was the World Championships. So all the best teams around the world were there. Obviously, we were really good. Like you said, it wasn't much competition at that stage. The international, obviously, over the last 20 plus years has really grown and continue to get better. There's so many more NBA players now coming from other countries. The world stage has gotten a lot better as a whole, you know, with all those teams. But at that particular point in time, we were very dominant and were pretty difficult to beat.
Did you keep any memorabilia from those World Championships or from your time playing basketball?
I have a lot of mementos, a lot of jerseys and a lot of, you know, things, whether it be bobbleheads or whatever. I have a lot of mementos from when my jersey was retired in Cleveland as well. But yeah, I had my gold medal, obviously, from the World Championships, and it was a lot of fun and a great experience.
Now, just moving into the 1995 season, it was your last with Cleveland. You played 48 games and averaged some good numbers, 16 points and 7 assists in not even 30 minutes per game. The Knicks would eliminate your team in the first round of the 95 playoffs. In September of that same year, after 9 seasons in Cleveland, you were traded to Washington. Do you remember how you heard the news of that trade, and what did you think as you were to relocate to Washington?
It was kind of a surprise over that summer. I got a call from Wayne Embry. You know, out of respect, I'd been there for 9 seasons, and it's the only place I'd ever played. I really considered, you know, Cleveland my team. I just assumed I would finish my career there. But I got a call that summer, and Wayne Embry, the general manager, talked to me and said they were in a rebuilding mode with all the guys that I played with pretty much gone. What would I think about, you know, being traded? If I would have said I wanted to stay, he probably would have kept me in Cleveland. But, you know, I told Wayne that, you know, it's a business. I understand. You need to do what's best, what you feel like for the franchise. And so I ended up getting traded to Washington that summer. I didn't play a lot that season. I was struggling with injuries, plantar fasciitis in my foot, but played for the Washington Bullets, as they were known back then. The fun part of that year was an opportunity to play with my brother, Brent, who was on that team as well. So it was really great to get to spend a year with him on the same team.
You've led me perfectly into my next question. That was going to be Brent, in contrast, had a great season, probably arguably his best in the league, averaging 10 points and 5 assists a game. What was it like to actually just be a teammate alongside your brother? Obviously, you didn't get to play a lot because of injury, and I'm glad you clarified what the injury was. I knew it was something to do with your foot. How was it, as far as at least being able to spend so much time alongside your brother, who had a great career in his own right too?
Yeah, it was fantastic. Just gave us a chance. I was 5 years older than Brent, so I left for college and kind of never went home when he was little. So it was a situation where we got to kind of reconnect and get to spend a lot of time with he and his wife at that time. And we had 3 small kids, so he got to, you know, spend time with our family, and it was awesome. You know, originally the plan was I was going to go there and be the starter. Brent was going to be my backup, and that would have been awesome. It really worked out well for Brent because I got hurt and I couldn't play that season. Another guy, Robert Pack, who they had brought in, got injured as well. And so really the last 30 games of the season, Brent was the starter there at Washington that season. And he had a great season that year and ended up getting a contract with the Houston Rockets after that.
Fantastic. And a teammate of yours in Washington, Jim McElvain, is a former guest and friend of the show. And I mentioned in passing that I'd be chatting to you at some stage, and he wanted to pass on his best to yourself. He was saying about how there was times where I think it was Brent, Jim, yourself. There might have been one other person whose name I'm blanking on at the moment, but you'd sometimes go to movies or whatnot when you were traveling on the road. He just spoke fondly of you and the time that you were in Washington, albeit you couldn't do as much on the court, of course, because of your injuries. But he wanted to pass on his best to you.
Yeah, Jim was a great guy. He was a great teammate. We had a lot of good guys on that team in Washington. And when we did go on the road, we would spend time together, you know, as a group. And it was a good time. You know, the one thing I would mention, you know, by an opportunity getting to play with my brother is I wonder how many sets of brothers have been able to both play at the NBA at the same time and things like that. So it was pretty neat that two 6-foot guys from Oklahoma both were able to make it to the NBA during the same time period.
Incredible, really. The chances of it are very slim, and names are escaping at the moment as to who else could have done that. I think the Van Arsdale brothers, they were teammates at one point. Yeah, Horace and Harvey Grant never played together as far as I can recall. But yeah, that's a really good point. You're in a very select group there, I'd say. In terms of 1996, later that offseason, you signed as a free agent with the Golden State Warriors and you'd played 70 games with the team. You averaged almost 12 points and 5 assists a game in about 27 minutes of contest. The Warriors were sort of in a bit of a rebuild sort of phase there. You went 30-52 and missed the playoffs. What was it like, though, to play on that Warriors squad and you were with another great future Hall of Famer, Chris Mullin? I've seen a few highlights from that season of the Warriors and some photos of you guys, and you certainly look to be enjoying your time on court and being even on the sidelines alongside these sort of guys. How did that sort of season play out for you, Mark?
Like you said, on the court, it was kind of a tough year. Like you said, it was a rebuilding season. Chris and I had known each other and played together. We played on the Pan American team together in 1983 and of course, knew each other for many years at the NBA, you know, all-star games and things like that. So it was fun to connect with him and get a chance to play with Chris. And, you know, you had guys like Latrell Sprewell and Joe Smith, who just got drafted. I think he was a first-round pick. Kind of a strange year because they were redoing the Oakland Coliseum at the time. And we actually played the season, all of our games in San Jose, where the San Jose Sharks hockey team plays their games. But so it was kind of a strange year overall and, you know, one that was, like I said, disappointing in the win-loss column for sure.
The final season in the NBA for you was 1998. Prior to the season beginning, you were traded to Orlando. The team went 41-41, and I checked the stats again today. You just missed the playoffs, I think, by 2 games. A bit unlucky there to miss out. You averaged almost 10 points and 5 assists a game in 23 minutes per game. What was it like to spend that final season in Orlando, and did you entertain any offers to continue playing beyond that season?
You know, the year in Orlando was, it was just a point in time in my life where I kind of felt that my career was winding down. Orlando was a nice city for my family and everything. We enjoyed that part of it. Penny Hardaway, unfortunately, got hurt and didn't play much that year. Had we have had him, we probably could have been a playoff team. We were, like you said, only a couple games out from making the playoffs, but we didn't. And I did have opportunities. A couple teams approached me to come play the following season, which ended up being a lockout season for the NBA that following year. I was just at a stage. I probably physically could have grinded out a couple more seasons, but mentally I was kind of ready to move on. I was pretty beat up, banged up the last few years of my career. I had 3 small kids at the time, and my family having to move 4 times in 4 years, you know, it was a little stressful on our family. And I just felt like it was at a time I kind of needed to settle down, get in one place and enjoy my family. And so I decided to retire.
Moving to late in 1999, we mentioned it a little bit earlier, Cleveland retired your jersey. It was November 13th of 99. The clip is on YouTube, and I implore anyone who's listening to go check this out. It's really touching. You were surrounded by family. You had Georgia Tech coach Kremens. You had Wayne Embry, who you mentioned before, Gordon Gund, former teammates. I think you had Craig Yellow and Danny Ferry were there. You had some video messages from Coach Wilkins, Brad Doherty, and there was a whole heap of former greats there to wish you well. What do you remember about that really special night, and where would you sort of rate that within all the achievements and recognition throughout your career?
It's right up there at the top. It was an amazing night. Like you said, I was just surrounded by so many people that I love, from family and friends and teammates that I played with, and, you know, so many people that, you know, were speaking so highly of me that night or whatever. It's just a very emotional night for me, just to know that, hey, I'd laid my heart and soul out there for 9 years in Cleveland, and the fans that had supported me all those years came out, and it was an unbelievable show of support, like I said, from my former coaches and owners of the team and management, and to the fans and my family. It was just an unbelievable experience.
Welcome to a very special halftime to honor a very special member of the Cavs basketball family, Mark Price.
And it is time now to welcome Mark Price, his wife, Laura, and children, Brittany, Caroline, Hudson, and Joshua, number 25, Mark Price. And now, Laura, Mark, whole gang, join Mark at center floor, because they're going to raise your number into the rafters.
At guard, 6 foot from Georgia Tech, number 25, Mark Price.
I got here in 1986, and not too many people gave me much of an opportunity to stick around here very long. This weekend has meant so much to me and my family, and I know this is my night to be honored, but I have to also thank you, Laura, because I wouldn't be here if it weren't for you either. I love playing here, and thank you for tonight. You're the best. Thank you. Thank you very much.
It says a lot when the quality of people who are there to present and help retire your jersey are going to go out of their way to do all that. So obviously you meant a lot to Cleveland. You're one of the all-time greatest players in franchise history, no doubt about that. Now you've got a wealth of coaching experience. It'll be almost another hour if we went through all the different bits and things that you've done across this time. But just in a nutshell, since about 2000, you've worked at the high school, college, and pro level. In terms of the NBA, you've worked with the Hawks as a shooting coach. You're a consultant for the Warriors, Orlando Magic assistant coach. You worked with the Hornets as an assistant. And earlier this month, as we record this, you were named as the assistant coach for the Denver Nuggets. So just before we get to the Nuggets there, how do you see the progression of your coaching career from when you first started in, circa 2000, and the experiences that you've learned along the way, coupled with your playing days, building up to where we are now?
You know, when I got through playing, I kind of, stepped away from basketball a little bit just to spend time with my family. And then I started doing some player development. You know, I opened up a shooting lab in outside of Atlanta, Georgia, and NBA teams started sending, players for me to work with. Got a chance to work with so many guys came through. A lot of guys that are still playing now, guys like Lou Williams and Al Horford and Thaddeus Young to Andre Iguodala. I mean, so many guys I've had an opportunity, even when I was with the Warriors, Steph Curry, spending some time with him and Kyle Lowry and Mike Conley when I was doing some things with Memphis. So, I've been fortunate and blessed to get a chance to work with a lot of really, really good players when they were young in their career and help them with their shooting and other parts of the game. And so that just kind of led teams kind of wanting me to come work with them full time. In a shooting coach position initially, like you said, with the Hawks right there. I was living in Atlanta, and so I did that for 2 years with them before I really jumped in with both feet as a full-time assistant coach. Didn't know that I wanted to do that. I grew up with a coach. My dad was a coach. I knew what kind of commitment it took, and I wanted to wait to a stage in my life where I felt like my kids were old enough that I felt comfortable doing that. I've been blessed to get a chance to work for a lot of great coaches and be a part of great organizations, and for most of my career at the NBA level. And then up until about 3 years ago, I coached at the college level as a head coach for a couple years at UNC Charlotte. And now I'm back in the NBA with the Nuggets again. So I've been blessed to be in opportunities to share my passion for the game, my love of the game, and more importantly, really try to pass on things that help me to be a good player, a good shooter, to younger players that are coming into the league right now.
Well said. Congratulations again on the recent appointment with Denver. Really excited for you. Just before we sort of wrap things up, how are things going in Denver? You've just recently relocated there. Training camp's only days away as we record this. What do you sort of see happening over the coming weeks? And you did mention before we got recording here today that your first preseason game is going to be against LeBron James and his new LA Lakers outfit. So how do you see the build up to that opening of the preseason, Mark?
Well, I think it'll be exciting for our team. You know, anytime LeBron's on the floor, I think all the other players get excited about playing against him. So it'll be a fun experience. We actually play our first two preseason games against the Lakers. For your Australian listeners out there, we actually play the Perth Wildcats.
All right.
This season in an exhibition game here in Denver. So that should be a lot of fun as well. But, you know, I'm really excited about the Nuggets team. I have a lot of really young, talented players. Nikola Jokic is a fantastic young big man in the league. Jamal Murray is an exciting young point guard. A lot of really good young talents, along with some veteran guys like Mason Plumlee, as well as Paul Millsap, so who's healthy again this year. So they've missed the playoffs by one game the last two seasons, and so I think they're really excited about trying to get over that hump and get in the playoff run this year.
Well, I wish you all the best with Denver for sure. And good to see there's a bit of a link to Australia in terms of playing against the Perth Wildcats, who are a great team over here and have won many championships over the years in our National Basketball League. Now, I love to ask a couple of quick questions to close out my conversations. And one of them is that Basketball Digest had a regular feature, which was called The Game I'll Never Forget. Now, we've covered your high school, college, and pro careers, and we may have already touched on one in particular, but does one game stand out above all others from your career?
Well, I think at every level I've had certain games that come to mind like that, but particularly I think at Georgia Tech, my junior year when we were able to win the ACC championship, beat North Carolina, the mighty North Carolina Tar Heels, three times in one season to do that was just unheard of. And we were a team that a lot of people said Georgia Tech was a program before I got there that they could never win in the ACC. So to kind of go from last place to first place in 2 years was an unbelievable experience. And that game of winning the first ACC championship for the school was certainly a game that I'll never forget.
Thank you for elaborating on that one for us. And the final question that I do like to throw out there is, did you have any particular significance to the jersey number or numbers that you wore throughout your career? Most people would know you as in the famous number 25. I know that you were 25th pick overall. I don't know if that's a coincidence or not going forwards, but at Georgia Tech, you had number 25. Then you wore, I think, number 15 with Washington and number 5 in Orlando. Was there significance to those numbers at all, Mark?
Well, the 25 number really started in high school. It was funny because my favorite number was 15. I liked 15. An older player on the team had 15, so I took 25 and kind of made that my own. And then when I went to college, I kept it at Georgia Tech. And like you said, it was coincidence. I was picked the 25th pick.
Yeah.
Draft, but I was able to get the number 25 in Cleveland as well and just kind of made that my number. Washington, when I got traded there, that jersey was actually retired. I believe a guy by the name of Gus Johnson. So I couldn't have it. So I took 15, kind of going all the way back to my high school days. I was able to get 25 when I went to Golden State again. But then when I got traded to Orlando, Nick Anderson had that number. And so I picked 5 just because, I don't know, it looked better than the other numbers.
I love it. Well, thank you for elaborating on that. There's usually some good reasons behind a player's number and some particular meaning to them. So I appreciate you telling me about that as well. Mark, it's been just an absolute treat to have this chance to speak with you for this period of time. You've been really generous. Thank you so much for chatting with me. And also thanks to Laura, your wife, who's been very helpful to help connect us over this period of time. I wish you every success in Denver and any future opportunities that do follow. Thanks again for joining me on the show.
Well, it's been a lot of fun, Adam. Let me reminisce about the good old days. I hope your listeners will enjoy it, and it's been a great opportunity. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening. I welcome your interaction with the show. You can suggest topics or guests you want to hear conversations with. Leave a voicemail. Simply visit inallairness.com/voice. Click start recording. Leave a message and press stop. You can even listen back before submitting. Press send and you're done. Time now to share another great review from a fan of the show. Thanks to Brady D on Apple Podcasts Australia.
It's titled Best Podcast, and it reads, "Love the podcast. Listening to episodes while I go for walks, so I'm losing weight and catching up with greats from the game's greatest era. The research is outstanding. The guest list is varied from former all-stars to role players. A great mix. If you are a fan of 80s and 90s NBA, this podcast is a must listen. Thanks very much, Brad. Though we haven't met in person, Brad, I know we've communicated many times online, and you're one of the biggest Nick Van Exel fans in the world. Absolutely, no doubt. I know you love your 90s NBA. Thank you for the review. I really appreciate the support, mate. Worldwide, the show currently has upwards of 75 reviews on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for your continued support. If you add a review, I'd love to read it out on a future episode. Your ratings and reviews are one of the best ways that you can support the podcast. If you enjoy the show, please do tell your basketball-loving friends about it. Your word-of-mouth recommendations are worth their weight in gold. Stay up to date with my podcast and subscribe to my monthly email newsletter. You'll receive exclusive details on upcoming podcast episodes, future high-profile guests to appear on the show, and more. Simply visit inallanis.com/news. You can subscribe to my show in various ways. Search for In All Airness, 3 words, on your podcast app of choice. The show is on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Android, Pocket Casts, and more. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show and share my web address with your friends and colleagues, inallanis.com. Check out the podcast archive for plenty more episodes with high-profile guests. Follow me on Twitter at inallanis. Please add your like to the show's social hub, facebook.com/inallanis. Join me next time for another edition of the show.